You'll hear this first hour, the incredible guitar and banjo work of Michael Miles from a great CD called A-Sides by Michael Miles. The second hour, you're going to hear the greatest ragtime pianist in America named Reggie Robinson. A Red Orchid Theater in the heart of Old Town, where I grew up, is, without argument, my favorite theater. And two of my favorite people from that theater, Shade Murray and Jennifer Engstrom, are in here to talk about not just the theater, but the fact that I, because of this radio show, cannot be there to participate in next Sunday's benefit for the theater and the ACLU. So I'm sorry, you two. I am sorry I can't do it.
We understand.
And we're going to miss you.
We know you're
busy. Very understanding.
We do.
You're very understanding. How did this benefit? A couple of years ago, or maybe 3 years ago, I was part of another benefit for the theater, and it is one of Chicago's, is the word intimate? What word do you use to describe the physical space of a Red Orchid?
On a polite day, it's intimate, and on a rowdy day, it's in your business.
People have been sprayed. People have had, I think, Michael Shannon's saliva somewhere on there, sprayed somewhere
yes,
on there.
Michael
person,
Shannon
sure.
has been a member of the ensemble.
I only mention him because he's mostly of note. But there's been everyone's saliva been on
there. Obviously, Michael's success in film and other places has obviously heighten the profile of the theater. If Michael was in a play there, I got to believe it sells out instantly, right? No matter what the play is. You know, the Rick Kogan story or some nonsense like that.
He was brilliant in that.
Yeah, was he? He could do it.
He's the only
actor I would allow to pull that off.
Yeah.
But the...
Yeah,
the,
we pimp him out for sure. Like when he's in town, he's doing a show, we know it's going to sell great. And he's very generous with his time.
Well, but also talking about, you know, Chicago theater, that's the way the great legendary Remains Theater operated with Bill Peterson. Billy would come back and do American Buffalo, and we sold out. We can get through the rest of the year. I did a benefit there. I was thrilled and honored to do it, talking with Brett Nouveau, playwright, actor, and Ike Holter, young playwrights, and I had such a wonderful time. And another reason I'm really upset that I can't do this one. But this benefit, how did this benefit come to be? And do you sit around and say, okay, we're gonna have a benefit. Okay, let's do something, because this one is fascinating. It's a stage reading of Angels in America, Part 1, Millennium. And those of you who don't know Angels in America, start a refresher course, because it's a dramatic thing. Mm-hmm. I know Hamilton's the hottest ticket in town, but if you have never seen Angels in America, you have missed something. So, Shade and Jen, how does the idea for this take shape?
It came out of despair and helplessness, which is as all good art does. Will Von Vogt, who is an actor in town, and he's also a producer. He helps produce a weekly event called Salonathon over at Beauty Bar. Mm-hmm. And he's one of the producers who helps put those evenings together. He and I really we're dear friends, and we were kind of checking in on each other and holding each other close in our post-election depression and bewilderment. And, you know, it was this time where I found myself isolating and not wanting to read things and engage in things and turn on to things and have people leave comments about things. And in that, we started to say that as artists, we felt so useless, that our talents and our skill set, we were like, people need to be putting their money towards so many things right now, and people need to be putting their time and their energy and their thought into so many things right now. Wow, putting on a play, what does that mean?
Yeah, right.
And then we were like, well, then what's the play? What's the play that we could put our energy in that has some muscle in it? And I remember, because I've read Angels so many times. I've never seen it in performance, and I've only read it. And I remember in the published version that I have, Tony Kushner had done his final after decades of writing both of these plays. It's in two parts, Millennium Approaches and Perestroika. And in
Millennium ends with
the angel coming
the
in.
The angel comes
and
out, right,
the
right,
great
right,
work
right.
begins. For I like to say that the first part is about things that you believe in falling apart. And the second part is about what emerges out of the rubble and rebuilding. And so I went back and I was looking at this and I said, well, if there was a time to put on just part one, because most people do each one in repertory so you could see them, I said, I think in an election year like this or the year after election year, I want to do the one about the communities, everything you believe in falling apart. And then I'd like to, in a election year, in a midterm year, do part two and do the rebuilding. And I looked in the prologue, and Tony Kushner, as he was, after these decades of writing and going in for what was going to be his final submission for the definitive version of the play, he has in his notes, he says, I'm submitting this on the evening before election day between Obama and Romney. And he says, a day where the nation is on the razor's edge between hope and despair.
Wow.
And I was like, Tony, you haven't seen anything.
No, yeah, right. Drama queen. No kidding.
And that then, and so then I started going, Romney's despair? Right?
Yeah, you haven't
seen it. And then I started thinking back and I was like, oh, right. This originally was produced on Broadway in 1992, 1993. And I was like, it was an examination of the Reagan years in the Clinton era. Yeah. And so we were already smooth sailing with the Clintons, looking back and at these people who are in the dawning of the Reagan era, these characters, and they have no idea what is about to happen. And they say, what does it mean for this man to be our president? What does it mean to be alive morally and socially and ethically and spiritually in the age of Reagan? And I then was thinking, I was like, well, so if Tony Kushner was feeling that way about during the Reagan years, and if he was then reexamining that during
the Obama Romney
years, and then I was like, so what does that mean now in the Voldemort era to be able to – do we always feel that we are on the edge of apocalypse? Or is it that we've kicked the can now so far down the road that this is the apocalypse? And I think that this play is constantly about that moment that history has nothing else to teach you, and you're in the nation and as a culture, we're facing a great unknown and something that tears at our souls, something that tears us apart. And one of the things that I hope to maybe get out of this is that is this just part of the national condition and we're always at that edge of apocalypse or what? So hopefully this will be a really interesting dissection between what history holds and what the future looms.
Well, Kushner must feel the same way because he donated the theatrical rights to you, as did Victory Garden donating the venue. I'm talking to Jen Engstrom, and we will talk to Jen Engstrom. We were both just listening to Shade Murray just talk so articulately about the meaning of this play. It is, again, Sunday night, minus Rick Kogan, but I'll tell you some of the people who are in this show. It is at Victory Garden Theater. You can go to aredorchidtheater.org to get all the information. Listening to the guitar work of Michael Miles. Now you're going to listen to Jen Engstrom is a large part of this next Sunday.
What's that supposed to mean?
It just means it's a big part of it. You sit tight, ladies and gentlemen. That is hardly an insult because of who she is playing in the stage reading of Angels in America, Part 1.
Truly.
Millennium Approaches, a ACLU and a Red Orchid Theater benefit, but also just a theatrical experience. Go to aredorchidtheater.org. You are playing Roy Cohn.
Roy Marcus Cohen.
Yes, one of the great evil characters, no matter what your definition of evil is, of the 20th century.
McCarthy, who has, lawyer. Yes,
and who is now bleeding into
his ghosts,
the current
have
president
tails
of the United States.
That have extended out of the play and out of the gravestone, and his legacy lives in our current president.
He was a, how should we say, a mentor?
He was a mentor. He was a mentor to a young Donald Trump in New York, and told him that if anyone ever sued him for anything, to fight right back dirtier.
Yep.
And we see that. And we see that he learned that really well. The one thing that Donald Trump learned well.
Did
he learned how to retaliate.
Did you ever see, Jen, the Al Pacino, Roy Cohn?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I did. I've been in the show as well.
Yeah.
I played the angel in Kansas City.
How daunting is it? I know it's a staged reading. How daunting is it for you to play this character?
We'll see. I mean, it'll be a challenge. Yeah. I've not played a man before. But I think I understand. I think I understand the core of this person without trying to make this person a monster. I think, like any human being, he is a human being, that he was wounded and obviously horribly ashamed of himself and his sexuality.
Sure.
That he, but he was a monster.
Yeah.
And and wanted to take out on other people the hatred that he felt in himself. And you know, that's bad. that's a bad legacy to have left. And so I'm glad that I get to
explore this character.
That I get to dig in there, because I can go dark. I think I
also, Jen, I mean,
was delicate.
Well, the last time Jen was and I were on the radio together, she was doing a Dorothy Parker show. There's a brilliant but also dark character there.
Yes.
I think Jen, your big thing is that you go for broke. And that's what those two also have in common, which is just when you have that friggin' lack of boundary.
That is true. I really don't know my own strength as an actor. Like, one of those people that when I was a kid, like when you did your homework, like I always just wrote really too hard on the paper. You know what I mean?
Everything is just like a little look.
And that's not to say that I'm a hammy over actor, but maybe
Shade, you're directing this thing, and how I would think that when you put the call out or let people know that you were doing this, that people jumped. I mean, really jumped on board. Yes,
It was a very quick casting process.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And and what's phenomenal is usually this play is done with 8 actors, and everyone plays multiple parts, and you've got five men and 3 women. And we decided that, especially like in a staged reading, when people are standing at a music stance, that it would be confusing to have people playing multiple parts and really being able to track, because they all look the same.
Yeah, I agree.
And then also we were like, well, at this time, and if we're doing this for the ACLU, let's get as many people as possible in playing one actor per character. So we have 20 actors who are going to be in the show.
All volunteering
their time.
Talent.
Actors Equity gave us waivers, so all the actors could donate their time. Everyone's doing this for free out of their passion for it. And we wanted it to be a show that really was throwing men's in some of the women's roles and women in some of the men's roles, and getting more people of color in the show, and really making sure that this also felt like the voice of the ACLU and was really playing with power dynamics and who it is who is able to play the voices of power or the voices of authority. And so that's been also really interesting.
I know it's a stage reading.
Yeah.
But have you done rehearsals yet? Do you even rehearse? You have to trust. I mean, you've got Jen Engstrom doing this, and Mirka and Ricky and all these other great actors.
You're hitting it, right? I mean, this is that moment where you get brilliance in the room and you just kind of point them at each other and you let it happen. We're spending time. We're having a lot of discussions. But our time actually together as a cast is very limited. But, you know, these people all know this play dearly, and these are all parts that they've been dying to play for a long time.
How did you get? Did you just write a letter to Kushner or call him and say, "Hey, can we do this?"
Yeah, yeah, that's we did. Yeah,
oh, good for you.
Yeah, and just said this is what it means to us, and he was like, "Yeah."
He, I brought my script when I met Tony Kushner, and he wrote, "Sorry, the epistle is so hard." That's in Perestroika, where the angel does come through and delivers this huge long screed about. Human progress needs to stop moving, hobble yourself, it's going too fast. And when I did that the epistle in, what was it, 2014, it sort of felt like abstract, like, yeah, things are going too fast, yeah, I kind of understand that, but like, now I really get what that means. Like, it feels like we're on this escalator that's just going right towards some sort of destination that we don't know where it is and we can't get off, and it's just going too fast.
Yeah.
And I finally understand the epistle now, I feel like, because but it is tricky and challenging and full of language. And so,
well, yeah. And that's also what I love, is that the play is, and this is why I think that you usually have eight people playing multiple parts. I think one of the huge things that this play is about is belief and what we choose to believe in. The first thing that you see a middle-aged woman coming out and saying that she's an elderly Jewish rabbi, and the belief that the audience, right, you take a leap of belief,
right,
and you suspend your disbelief and you're in. And then you spend time with people who believe in things that most theater goers don't. They believe in Mormonism. They believe in Reagan. They you see people who believe in their marriages realize that that's not true, or people who believed in their country or believed that they were a certain sexual orientation and that's not true, or people who just believe that they were good people, that they were decent people, and realizing that maybe they're not. And then throughout all of that, right, as all of that's falling apart, this angel kind of comes in and says, we're going to start working on something new. We're going to start working on something different.
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think the whole Angels in America is about a lot of things, but it is also, to my mind, has ever struck me about how fragile everything is.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Is that a too deep a read?
No, there's a character who's obsessed with climate change. And again, this was, you know, written back in the late 80s and performed in the early 90s. But her whole thing is that she wants to go to Antarctica because she identifies with this thing that's slowly melting away, that is so precious and needed. And they talk about the ozone layer. Mm-hmm, and just mm-hmm. The idea that there are such tenuous, small, seemingly accidental things that are so strong and yet so easily obliterated.
That's the thing. It is Angels in America. It's a reading, staged reading. If you've never seen a stage reading, I think stage readings are very cool, frankly, very cool. It takes place next Sunday at 6 p.m. at Victory Gardens Theater, which is very close to where John Dillinger was killed after seeing a movie at what is now Victory Gardens Theater, one called the Biograph Theater. It's just north of Fullerton on Lincoln Avenue. Tickets are $50. It all goes to the ACLU and to a Red Orchid Theater. It stars, and I'm saying this, Jen, it stars Jen Engstrom in the amazing role of Roy Cohn, but it also features so many other actors. Mirka Gertin, who adored, the legendary Natalie West, who was in the aforementioned Remains theatrical ensemble, and so many others. You can go to a Red Orchid, where is that thing? A Red Orchid Theater with an RE.org to get all sorts of information and to buy tickets. We'll take a break. You'll hear some news, and then I will talk to these nice people. I will promote that show again, but we'll talk a little more about A Red Orchid, because I just want beyond Michael Shannon,
yes,
beyond the fame and in incredible talent and nice guy that he is, and beyond the fact that Bruce Elliott, the proprietor of the Old Town Ale House, is certainly his favorite theater in all the world.
Because it's closest, I think.
In all the world.
Because he can stumble over there.
Because many of the ensemble members patronize the Old Town Alehouse.
Indeed, they do.
And he has fallen in love with many of them.
And wants to paint them.
Yes, he does. Because, yes, he does. Because that's what Bruce does.
That's right.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago. A few more minutes with Shade Murray and Jennifer Engstrom, both of a Red Orchid Theater, which is putting on a benefit for the ACLU and a Red Orchid Theater, that's spelled with an R-E, a stage reading of Angels in America, Part 1, Millennium Approaches. It is next Sunday night, 6 p.m. at Victory Gardens Theater. It's only $50, and you're going to see some of the great theatrical. Is Ike Holter a good actor?
He's a phenomenal actor.
Is he a good actor? Yeah. He's a good playwright. He's going
to
be a...
He's a great personality. He's great to have on stage.
He's a nice kid, and he used to run the box office at Red Orchid. How long have you two been involved in Red Orchid?
I was named an ensemble member in 03.
And I don't know when I became an ensemble member. It feels like 2010.
Describe. You know, I find Red Orchid not only, you know, consistently artful, but give me the sort of creative philosophy of a Red Orchid, if you can, Shade.
Yeah. So the name comes from, is it from Naked Lunch?
Yeah.
So there's a passage in Naked Lunch by William Burroughs where someone is injecting heroin. Mm-hmm. And as they put the needle into the vein, in this moment of like despair, a little drop of blood makes its way back up into the syringe and blossoms like a red orchid. And that became our moniker because the idea is that even in the lowest moments, even in the most marginalized or controversial moments, that there is odd and surprising
beauty. Yeah.
And so that's really what we're constantly looking at. I think that we tend to put people on stage that most people don't think twice about and hopefully show them something new or fresh or beautiful or familiar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Michael Shannon, who's been a member of the ensemble for quite a while, has become sort of, you know, I guess Michael's world famous. He's still an incredibly nice guy and sort of unaffected and still will occasionally drop in the Old Town Ale House for drinks. But it's an amazing ensemble, many of whom I know. Natalie West is a relatively recent addition, last few years to it, coming back to theater after raising two great kids. She was a member of Remain's ensemble. What's coming up this? What's the new season look like?
It's our 25th anniversary.
Wow.
25 years in the same space.
Wow.
We've always been over there at over in Old Town.
Sort of across the street, kind of across the street from Zany's.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right.
Frame of reference.
And so we've got, we're starting off with a new play by Wallace Shawn that is called Evening at the Talk House. And it is a really funny and politically charged piece about, again, artists in a bit of a politically bankrupt era trying to figure out how to survive and kind of cannibalizing one another.
And that'll have Natalie West and Kirsten Fitzgerald, our artistic member.
And Lance Baker. We'll all be in that. And Wallace Shawn is going to come and spend some time with us getting this launched.
What was his play? Aunt Dan and Lemon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Designated Warner.
And he's also a very good actor, too.
He was the inconceivable guy in The Princess Bride.
That's right.
Inconceivable.
Right.
And then, meanwhile, while we're doing that, then you're going to be in New Jersey, in Princeton.
We are remounting a production that we did at Red Orchid in 2011, I think I want to say, of Sam Shepard's Simpatico.
Oh, wow.
With Mike Shannon, Guy Van Swearingen, Doug Vickers, Mirica Gurton, and myself, and Kristen Ellis, and directed by Dado. And we're going to be doing it at the McCarter Theater in Princeton, New Jersey.
Very exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Very exciting.
And then Brett Nevue, who's an ensemble member, is taking a show that he wrote called Traitor, and that's going to be directed by Mike Shannon.
Wow.
And Natalie's going to be in that. Guy Van Swearingen, Larry Grimm,
Danny McCarthy.
Danny McCarthy. some extraordinary actors, and it's taking Ibsen's Enemy of the People and placing it on Chicago's North Shore.
Oh, I love that idea.
And yeah, and so it's just, and he's going to kind of explore the Chicago political machine and the alderman machine and our responsibility to communities.
A Red Orchid being two blocks from where the famous Patty Bowler ran his saloon. Famous,
yes.
Chicago ain't ready for reform, alderman.
Yes.
I so admire what you guys and girls and women and men do there. And I so wish I could be part of your event next Sunday. Next Sunday at 6 o'clock at Victory Gardens Theater is a benefit stage reading of Angels in America Part 1, Millennium, featuring, I won't say starring, but featuring the great Jen Engstrom as the most evil man of the 20th century. And that's saying something. Yes. Wow, Hitler, most evil lawyer of the 20th century. And that's saying
something. And that's saying something, too.
And that is saying something. For tickets and to learn more about A Red Orchid, it is I consider it the most intimate theater space in Chicago. Go to aredorchidtheater with an RE.org to know how much I love and admire you. So,
thanks. Well, back we always love you, having you in the house. And while we can't have you on Sunday, please come and do another event with us.
Oh, anything you want.
It's good stuff.
Anything you want.
And one last thing, yes, which I'm super proud of. We keep selling out our subscriptions, and so we actually have to stop and turn people away.
Fantastic.
So right now we're in the middle of, and I'm only bringing that up because we're selling tickets right now, and we're going to stop in a couple of weeks because we can only take
because
70
you're
people.
Small,
we have 70 seats.
The That's ultimate it. Intimate theater. Yep. That's what I call it, the ultimate intimate theater, and we're going to try to get Bruce Elliott, the legendary proprietor of the Old Town Ale House, to do a group portrait of the entire ensemble,
just the id
wearing
of all of
whatever
us.
Bruce
just
thinks they should be wearing.
Love it.
We'll be back in a couple minutes, and Lise Graham, the producer, will run a segment for you about something that she has discovered is called Voice Box Stories that takes place at Fitzgerald's. We'll be back in a couple minutes. That is the guitar work of Michael Miles, with whom I do that show at the Hideout, the third Tuesday of every month. So this one is on the 20th, and I think it's about, I'll tell you what it's about next week. Lise Graham, the incredibly talented young and art-centric producer of this show, not only does she have her own podcast called Lise FM that you can find by just looking for it, she also is passionate, and I do mean passionate, about the arts of all sorts. So she told me earlier this week, Rick, I have two friends who do a very interesting show at Fitzgerald's once a month. One is Maureen Muldoon, the other is Kathy Richardson. They're friends of mine. I said, that doesn't matter if you think they're talented. And Kathy, are you on the phone?
I am. Hello.
Kathy, hi. Yeah, I've been seeing Kathy for many years. She also did a great collaboration with our mutual friend, Bucky Hawker, who himself is a grand talent. All right. And Maureen, how are you?
Hi, good, great.
Good.
Thanks for having us.
It is called Voice Box Stories. I'm going to allow Lise to conduct this interview because this is not a podcast. This is real radio. Go.
Oh, gosh. Well, okay.
Behave yourselves, ladies.
we'll try.
All three of you, ladies.
I wanted to start out by reading a little bit of what Maureen reads at the very beginning of each of these nights. It's a story, a slam, a song, a serenade, a surrender, a place to be heard and hear about the human condition. It's community. It's alive. It's entertaining and elevating. It's the old school front stoop. It's the modern day confessional, where folks like us who need to create and come out and connect go to spin and weave and unfurl, to encounter artistry and escape into inspiration. Where a song leads to a story, and a story leads to a song, and the beat goes on and up. And Maureen does it way better than I do, but that is Voice Box. So
let me get in for a second. How did you find this, Lisa?
Well, a friend of my mom's named Jean, she has been going to it for a couple years. And so she started bringing my mom, and my mom started talking to me about it. And she was like, you got to come to the storytelling. Sorry, Mom. You've got to come to the storytelling night. They sing and they tell stories, and it's awesome. And I was like, okay, yeah. But then I finally went and I fell in love with it.
So. Let me ask you, too. I do want Lise to run this whole thing, but there are a number of storytelling ventures going on. I think it's incredible in this town. You know, they're all over the paper machete, and I could go on and name a dozen of them. Did any in particular inspire the two of you?
Well, actually, I came from Los Angeles storytelling. So I was out in L.A. doing television and film and doing one of the local shows there is called Lit Up, and it was live literature. And that's really the one that inspired me. And when I got to Chicago about 80 years ago, Kathy and I met up, and the real inspiration for our show was my dad, who would break into a story or a song at the drop of the hat. And so I thought, what's missing from my, optimal idea of a story night is singing.
Yeah.
And Kathy and I, my jaw dropped, and I was like, could you please do this with me?
She's dropped a lot of jaws in this town, believe me. I think that's a great idea. Go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, so you guys started 4 years ago. Tell us about the very first Voice Box. Was it a total, basically dress rehearsal, or was there a lot of preparation beforehand?
Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, I was going to say the very, very first one, Maureen staged and another woman, incredibly talented singer-songwriter woman. Her name is escaping me right now. What is her name?
Megan McDonough.
The music.
Oh, Megan's been on this show. Megan's the greatest, yeah.
Yeah, phenomenal. Amazing. And, Maureen staged it at this little black box in Oak Park, and I went and I watched, and I said, yeah, I can do this, But the idea of it is that what makes it really different from a lot of the other storytelling nights, and even a lot of them incorporate music now, but the themes of our stories are song titles. So the night will start out with the song. That's the theme.
Do you two pick the songs collaboratively, or Kathy, do you just pick a song?
No,
I like to pick songs that she would never pick.
exactly. But it's awesome because, I'm playing with my acoustic guitar, and the theme, for October is Thriller, and I'm like, how am I going to do that? So it's been really amazing for me to just get into doing all these different kinds of songs that I literally never would do. And then the other twist of this storytelling night, which makes it so special, is that while the songs are being played, I'm in the audience listening to the story for the first time. And after each story is done, I jump up and I spontaneously do a song inspired by their story. And I have no idea at the beginning of the night what songs I'm going to play and whether I'm even going to know them or not. So it makes it very exciting. It adds an exciting twist.
Maureen, when you're picking, you guys have had a variety of storytellers. How does the whole application process work? Or is it, they're mostly told with notes. They're all written down, right?
A lot of them are live lit, which is people writing the stories down and bringing them in. It's not just live lit. We like to have regular storytellers come up as well. And we have a nice group of people. Now, the thing is that most of the story nights that you hear about in the Chicago area are actually in Chicago.
Yes.
And there aren't really that many out here. So this was like bringing it to Fitzgerald. It tapped into a whole new group of people, some people who never get to experience live storytelling. And so so we were like, you know, Lee said, we were big with the moms for a while. We also a lot of, you know, other, you know, people who are finally finding us and coming out and having a, you know, a great night of storytelling and music. And the way that you get on the stage is in the very beginning to build a pool of storytellers, we had something called the five sentences. And after all the storytellers would get up, and after Kathy sang all these brilliant songs, we would invite the audience to get up and tell us a five-sentence story. And it got people to kind of dip their toe in the storytelling pool. And from that, we've ended up having a really great tribe of storytellers who build their confidence and understand what works, what doesn't work. And so we usually book up a couple months in advance now, but we no longer do the five sentences. So that was just something that we did to help build community.
Lise, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
That aspect of it is certainly reminds me of you know, Mark Smith's legendary of the whole poetry slam
right.
notion. Mm-hmm. Does it not?
Yeah.
For you guys? Yeah. For you ladies?
I think so.
And I think also, it also, and then it's going to be all Lisa's interview, you must be gratified that I believe that there is a huge need as this world becomes sort of technologically icier for people to express themselves. Do you yes. get that sense, even someone who comes in and is kind of shy, to see them mm-hmm. come out of that shell and write something to express themselves? It must be so gratifying for you too, yes?
Absolutely. Oh, my God. There's so many nights where you're just like, holy cow, what just happened? I mean, I went through every gamut of every emotion. People, you know, you're sitting there laughing and all of a sudden you're crying and you don't even know what happened. And these people are telling their, you know, pouring their hearts out, and all stories are true. So every story has to be a true personal story. So that's what makes it really amazing. And there's so many different voices and the way mm-hmm. people tell their stories. I mean, it's just, it's mm-hmm. it's infinite. It's infinite.
Yeah.
Are there any moments from the past 4 years that really stick out to you, either of you, both of you, as just like definitive voice box?
Oh, wow. I got to say that what impresses me, what, you know, what I find awe-inspiring is that I do read the stories beforehand, and I do, you know, work with the storytellers a little bit. What I find amazing is that night after night after night, a storyteller will get up and tell a story. Kathy's never heard it before, and she'll get on stage and sing the most impeccable song that goes with it. Mm. And the song actually gives us time to digest the story. And I think it's magical, the not just the talent that Kathy has, but that there's a really, and, you know, Megan McDonough was able to do it too, but it takes a really special musician to have that toolbox of talent to have tons of songs, you know, first of all, and the willingness and the courage to even sing songs that they don't know, but because it has to be sung because it's perfect for that story. So I think just that part of it is that the audience kind of waits with bated breath to say, what is she going to sing? And how are we going to move into a deeper meaning of this story through a song? Mm. It's beautiful.
I love that. Yeah.
Now, are you guys, yeah, I know you're at Fitzgerald's. When are you at Fitzgerald's? And where else are you? It seems you're elsewhere too, right?
We're at Fitzgerald's every second Tuesday of the month. And we have been there for, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years?
5 years. Yeah, we're in our fifth year.
Okay, yeah. So, and we're normally in the club, but in the summer months, we're moving into the sidebar because it's other, you know, events that are going on in the club in Fitzgerald's. But we've been, it's the second Tuesday. So this coming Tuesday, June mm-hmm. 13th, is our next show.
And then we had a show up in Geneva. But we couldn't get the community going. We put it on hiatus for a little while. And then we do a lot of charity events. So we did a charity event for Oak Park Art League, and we did a charity event for a wellness community. So we love to do shows like that where we build a show around your charity to support communities and little and storytellers in littler communities and get to hear the stories of, you know, of the charity members and the people who volunteer. Like, that's always a blast for us.
I have one more question. Maureen, this one's for you. What makes a good story? What makes a good a story, you know, out loud as opposed to something on the page?
Good question.
Thank you.
That it stays close to the bone. Not too many people can carry off a story that rambles too much. The audience has to go with you. So to go, you know, to go slow enough and to stay close enough to the bone of the story that that we're with you. The one thing I noticed about new storytellers is they want to fit everything in their first story, you know, and it's like, no, wait, that's like 8 years of, you know, of great stories. Just give us, you know, the one time that you spilled the milk, you know, that'll be good enough. You know, don't worry.
Yeah.
So I would say don't play all your cards at once. You'll get another chance. Like, just tell one really simple, good story. And then it should follow the hero's journey, that you should come to the story from a place of having gleaned something from it, so that you are returning something to the community. You know, a half-baked story is when you end at the crucifixion and not the resurrection. So, you know, come to us from a holy place of, you know, I got back up. You know, that's what I would say. I don't care for stories that aren't that are told from a victim's standpoint, and nothing like that goes on stage at Voice Box.
Really quick, I want to talk really quick about Sunday Speakeasy, and both of you are involved in that. Can you tell us what that is?
Well, Sunday Speakeasy is for the people who, want to have a broader conversation around spirituality. You know, it's almost like going to, instead of going to an Italian restaurant or a French restaurant, you're going to a buffet. And so at Speakeasy Spiritual Community, you'll get a talk on Judaism or Buddhism. We say love is our religion, care is our currency, and peace is our goal. And, you know, at this point in history, I think it's really important for us to find common ground. And Speakeasy is one of those places that we do that every Sunday.
And that's in Hinsdale.
Yeah. 10 a.m. And Kathy's the
Emmanuel
Hall director there.
Well, yeah. Lise Graham, you're the greatest talent scout I've ever encountered in my life. And you two, this thing sounds beyond intriguing to me. Go to Voice Box Stories. I'm not going to insult you listeners and spell it for you. VoiceBoxStories.com. Maureen Muldoon and Kathy Richards. And I don't know you, Maureen, but I've admired Kathy for many years. One of the great singers.
And
Kathy collaborated with half the people I know. Okay, this is, at least you've also found me another story for the newspaper. I will be out there. I can't do it this week, but I'll be out there soon to see this. It sounds really intriguing. And the fact that it was born out of storytelling in L.A. is like, are you kidding? Who tells stories in L.A.? I thought everybody was writing screenplays out there. Ladies, thank you so much. And Lise Graham, thank you too. You were the greatest talent scout and a great interviewer. Now I have, ladies and gentlemen, on this show called After Hours, there are a lot of people in this town I admire. I cannot, and I'm not just saying it because they're both here, I cannot think of two people I admire more than Tim Samuelson, who's been a friend for a long time. He is the cultural historian. That's an official title of the city of Chicago. Is that still your title?
Well, that's what it says on the card anyway.
Yeah. One of the great people. Nobody knows. If my father was still alive, it would be a very interesting conversation to see who knew more about Chicago than my father.
Oh, your dad would clean my clock.
No way.
Oh, sure he would.
And I think one of the most creative, interesting musicians I have ever met, and I have spent my life interviewing creative, interesting musicians, Reginald Robinson. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Well, thanks.
We're going to talk. We're specifically here to talk about an event next Saturday called An Evening at the Pekin Theater, which I guarantee you people, few of you have ever heard of, because I had never heard of it. We're going to get into that, but I want to talk to these two guys about their life and career because we have the entire hour. We will. The show's free, ladies and gentlemen, so don't worry about having to go to a website or do anything crazy like that. You can go to the show next Saturday. Reginald's going to play. You're going to talk there, Tim?
No, I'm just going to sit back and watch the show. So
that's fantastic.
Great.
That's fantastic.
Perfect for me.
Beside going, Reggie, you might like some of this stuff too. I know that when you were young, you fell in love with history. And you would take yourself downtown from the north side and go to old buildings and try to take things from old buildings, like much like Richard Nickel, the famous photographer who was upset by the destruction of certain buildings in this town. What fired your interest in history?
You know, I think I just did it all my life. And there was something about history and old buildings that had an attraction to me. And it almost was like they were kind of alive. You could pick up a vibe from them. So I enjoyed reading about things, and I read about the buildings downtown. I was in grade school, and my parents thought I was down at the playground, and you know, I wasn't supposed to cross the busy streets. Well, I figured out how to get on the CTA all by myself.
How old were you?
Oh, I was probably about 8 years old. And so I would go downtown and look for these different buildings. And it was great to just show up. I never wanted to know exactly where they were because I knew what they looked like from pictures and books. But I loved the idea that they would just suddenly appear before me. And so I did this, you know. Actually, I'm still doing it today. So
yeah,
I guess I never grew up.
Well, there's another guy we both know who did something like that, an artist named Jack Simmerling. He was sort of working for his dad and going down to the old buildings at Prairie Avenue and finding things and falling in love with the history of things.
Oh, absolutely. Jack was amazing, and he was doing it before anybody. And he was going, and he joined the wrecking crews and helped salvage the pieces of historic buildings, and he'd take them home. Then he would research the history of them. And he was a great artist, as you know.
Oh, no question.
And he would make these wonderful portraits and line drawings of them. And it was interesting where Jack and I would get together because there was a little difference in age between us, but we kind of did the same thing. And we would laugh that we were somehow brothers or relatives that somehow got separated early on. And even those in our family that are close, they'd kind of laugh when they'd see the two of us together and just kind of shake their heads. And you know,
he did have an amazing house. One of the most amazing houses I've ever been in. Reginald, you two are drawn to the past. You came upon music. You grew up in the Henry Horner homes, and your brother started playing music on a guitar. And you said, well, I kind of think that's kind of interesting, right?
Yeah, that was the beginning of my interest in older music forms. My brother was listening to music, you know, like Tommy Dorsey,
yeah,
Benny Goodman, and people like that, Artie Shaw, and you know, all these big band leaders. From the late 1930s and early 40s.
What do you think? How did he get turned on to that?
I think just looking to be different. He wanted to be different in a lot of ways. He was interested in music. He started listening to.
He used to listen to Chuck Shaden's
old radio show,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah, and he turned me on to that radio show, and I started listening to those, you know. Actually, we kind of grew up listening to old-time radio back.
Interesting because it obviously was not what all your friends were listening to, was it?
No.
It's Jackson 5 or whoever. I don't even know.
At that time, it was like Michael Jackson and Prince. I listened to that music as well. And I also had an interest in the old buildings as well. That came along with the ragtime. I would see some buildings. When I got into listening to ragtime, I began to realize the time period. I used to originally thought it was like the 1920s, and then I come to find out it was much earlier. And then right around me, I started noticing some buildings had years on them, like 1900, 1899. Yeah. I was like, wow, this was built during that period.
Well, one of the interesting things for you, which Tim can talk about too, is when you fell in love, Orbert Davis was one of the first people to sort of turn you on to, he came and visited your school, and you heard the entertainer, Scott Joplin's the entertainer, and yes. Scott Joplin's relationship, Tim, with the 1893 Columbian Exposition is, can't be denied. I mean, this is, talk about, both of you guys, talk about how that visit influenced Joplin.
Well, certainly in terms of Scott Joplin coming to Chicago, and, you know, everyone came to Chicago for the fair.
Sure.
And so trying to piece this together, it's a little hard to follow the trek, but it was a real convergence of music. In fact, it's very interesting. There was something on the Midway called the Dahomian Village, and it was people from Africa who were performing. And there are stories of people who heard the music at the Dahomian Village, which in many ways changed the way people thought about music syncopation and carried through as well. And there's even one early band leader who said that hearing the musicians at Dahomian Village really was the beginning for him of what later became ragtime, which then evolved into jazz, and the lineage just keeps going.
Reginald Robinson, as the leading you are. Don't, Reggie's such a nice kid. He's like smiling, being self-effacing. What do you think it was? I know this is a really hard question to answer because it's like a psychological mystery question. What was it about ragtime when you first heard it? I think, you know, it might have been Scott Joplin's famous The Entertainer, that you said you were beyond intrigued. You were impassioned.
Well, I guess it was the difference from the big band music I was hearing. That was the beginning of it, listening to the big band music and beginning to understand what that music was all about, and just the music itself. And then when I heard the ragtime, which I had already heard as a child coming up in school, and coming up in my earlier life.
Yeah.
You know, then when I heard it at school, the entertainer played, I heard it at this solo piano, and I was like, wow, that doesn't need a band. You know, it was a contrast from hearing the band play and then hearing one musician play. And that one tune, I was like, wow, this is serious. It's serious, and it's, I can do that.
And you taught yourself to play, didn't you?
Yeah.
This is an amazing story. Tim Samuelson has taught himself to be a historian and a writer and all sorts of things, and the world's leading expert on Popeil. That's why these two are so fascinating. Again, they're going to be doing an event next Saturday, or this coming Saturday, and we'll tell you all about that, but I still want to explore their life and background and history, because they both love the history of this city and the history of, in Reginald's case, the history of music, too. And that is something I share with them. Saturday night, the Illinois Humanities Gang is presenting an evening at the Pekin Theater. It's featuring my guest here, Reginald Robinson, performing, and my other guest here, Tim Samuelson, partaking. You're just going to sit there and listen,
right? I'm going to sit there and listen.
How did this whole thing come to be?
Oh, gosh. I think it was probably both of our interest in the history of ragtime and the Pekin, because I kind of go back as well, because when I was in grade school looking at buildings, I also collected old sheet music that I'd find in resale stores. And I had a grade school teacher who in her early years had played the piano for silent movies. So I would take the sheet music to the teacher, and she would stay after school and play them for me.
Oh, wow.
So I was listening. In fact, I even sang before the school assembly on talent night, the Pussycat Rag, which barely qualifies as ragtime. But anyway,
I've never heard you sing. Are you? Oh, Reggie, have you ever heard him sing?
You don't want to hear it.
Oh, we do want to hear it. Yeah, we do. Oh, no, we do want to hear it.
Especially that song.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, so, but Reginald had the same. So it kind of, this idea of knowing about the Pecan and knowing that it was totally off people's radar.
Oh, that is no kidding. And we were just talking here during the commercial about the fact that, you know, the Tribune has been a, you know, you think of newspapers as being the chronicle of the city in which they're printed, and they will print all the news. There is nary a mention of the Pecan Theater or, Reggie, you said, of Ragtime in this paper until Howard Wright found you. That's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that just, what do you guys think about that? I don't want to make it a sort of racial thing, because the Pecan, the interesting thing about the Pecan Theater is this guy Mott, his notion was to have mixed crowds too.
It was, it's interesting. Of course, what now in doing historical research, the Tribune is one that you can actually do keyword search,
sure,
and it's online,
yeah,
and so it winds up being a prominent voice in research. And you not only don't find much mentioning the Pecan, but you don't find much about what was happening in the African-American community of the South Side at all. But for such a major theater to be doing such innovative work and not mentioned at all, and I mean, there were extensive theatrical reviews that...
What is the first, when you think of it as the first Black-owned musical and vaudeville theater, not just in Chicago, but arguably in this country, its importance is tremendous.
Well, I'll say this. In that time period, from what I come to realize, it was not important. It wasn't important news.
Wow.
In the Tribune. And
anywhere.
You know, in Black newspapers and in Black society, it was important.
Yeah, I mean, really that's was written up a lot in, say, the Chicago Defender, the African-American. Yeah. And also, there were publications that were of national scope for African-American audiences. And there are mentions of the Pecan. Probably one of the only kind of general notices is there was a theater magazine that actually did a two-page story about the Pecan. Took one of the few...
A Chicago-based theater magazine?
No. It was actually a New York-based magazine. And it even had one of the few photographs we have of performers on stage. And when you read the story, it's actually kind of embarrassing the way they cover it. A very kind of... how would you describe that story, Reginald?
I'd rather not say.
Okay, well, let's just say it's troubling to read. But so when it was mentioned at all, anyway.
Yeah. It was at 27th and South State Street where this event will take place. What's there now, an empty lot?
Empty lots, parking lots. It is the most forgettable, anonymous place you could ever go. Anyone who has ever driven down that area of State Street has never given this a second thought, because the building's been gone for a long time. How inspired can you get about a parking lot?
But I want to say this. From being interested in ragtime music and just old music and the artists who played it, most everything in Chicago that relates to Black music, those monuments are gone.
Yeah.
Where Tony Jackson lived, it's gone. It's an empty lot.
Muddy Waters' house is still around, but it's like falling apart, and it's not. It's certainly not as esteemed as it should be. Yeah. Does that, as a African American artist living and working and composing and playing in Chicago, how does that make you feel? And it's like this huge part of your past, even though it's not directly part of your past, is just sort of erased.
Well, it's sad in one sense.
Yeah.
I think that most importantly is African-American people it's good for African American people to stay in touch with the history.
No question.
History, and to know beyond buildings being destroyed or whatever, to stay in close touch with the history. Don't, you know, and pass it on. So it's not forgotten.
And I think, you guys are going to stay on all the way to 11. I think that's a really interesting thing to talk about, in especially, I think, as blacks in this city have become increasingly, to my mind, disenfranchised. I mean, I think it's, you know, yes, there was redlining. Yes, there was the great Black Belt where people were forced to live. But there was also Bronzeville in its glory days. Tim, we've got 5 minutes in this segment, and we're going to go all over the place and talk about stuff. This place, the Pekin Theater, was in, you know, Bronzeville. What was in Bronzeville before there was Bronzeville was a prison camp, Camp Douglas, basically part of Bronzeville. But by the night, do you know that, Reggie?
I didn't know that.
Camp Douglas is a fascinating story to me.
Right in the same area, sure.
Yeah, right in the same area where Lake Meadows is now. But when the glory days of Bronzeville, this place, the Pekin Theater, was started, if memory serves, in 1904, 1905 or something, and then after Mr. Mott died in 1911, nobody really figured out how to keep it going. He was a gambling boss, and he was a great character, but none of his relatives could figure out how to keep it going. What was the height of Bronzeville? The glory days of Bronzeville were in the 20s, yes?
That would be when it became a real city within a city, where there was the need for an alternative community that would have both a business community by day, an entertainment community by night, because the existing mainstream business and entertainment communities totally excluded African Americans, or for the most part did. And so the Chicago's community set up its own city within a city, and it centered it on its both its commercial and its entertainment identity on South State Street. So by day in the late teens and the early 20s, you would have black-owned insurance companies and banks and tea rooms and a variety of business enterprises that were kind of a counterpart to what you would have.
To downtown.
Yeah. And by night, it became this interesting entertainment Rialto where you would go on a Saturday night and get dressed up, and the music would come spilling out of the different saloons and entertainment and music halls, and you would kind of be attracted to go inside and hear.
Did white Chicago come down there on any level? I think of, you know, sort of New York, and let's all go to Harlem and do that scene, the almost slumming in Harlem. It didn't.
It was the same as Harlem.
Yeah, there was some of that, and there were clubs that were known as Black and Tans.
Right, right.
And in fact, in its later incarnation, the Pekin was a Black and Tan. It was a dance hall, and that was a place where you'd go and say, "Let's go to the, you know, down to the South Side and hear this new thing they called jazz." And so it had evolved from a entertainment venue and cultural venue into a dance hall. In fact, it was considered a dance hall of pretty, really challenging repute, let's say.
Yeah, sure.
And eventually was shut down altogether. Very different from what it would have been when Robert Mott's owned it.
This is a great opportunity for you people, not just to hear one of Chicago's great performers, but also to learn something about this city Saturday night when you go down to Bronzeville at 27th and State to partake of this, an evening at the Pekin Theater. Go ahead, Reggie.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I won't be playing alone. I'll be playing with some luminaries, jazz musicians.
Yeah. But I always think you alone is good enough for me to go to 27th State. We'll talk about everybody else who's playing, and you will hear Reginald Robinson, because one of the things I want to talk to him about, I think one of the last times I saw him, I went to his house on the near his crib on the near west side, and to interview him because he was he was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant. And I want to talk about how, because I didn't talk about how it was changing your life. It was just like, hey, aren't you glad to have this? And you go, oh yeah, Rick, I'm really glad to have this. So we'll talk about, because I think you did wonderful things with the money and the freedom that the money brought. So stay tuned for that. And right after we come back, you will hear Reginald Robinson play. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Reginald Robinson, who is a MacArthur Genius Award winner, Tim Samuelson and I, who are not MacArthur Genius Award winners. Reginald is almost without, I would say without argument, the greatest ragtime composer, performer on the planet. I want to talk about how your life changed when you got the MacArthur, but I first want people to listen to you. What are they going to listen to?
You're going to be listening to a tune called Pekin Rag, which I recorded back in the 90s. I was that interested in Joe Jordan way back from
that. That's when you got into that long ago you recorded this.
Actually, I got interested in Joe Jordan right around the time I found out about Scott Joplin, discovered
Scott
Joplin.
Wow, same time. That's really interesting. Because they had at the Pekin Theater, they had their own band. They did opera music as well as ragtime. So here, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure, is Reginald Robinson. That's great, Reginald. That's really, really beautiful. When you, and I don't want to belabor this, I want to talk more about the event and more about Bronzeville and more about ragtime and more about why we forget certain things that were huge parts of the city's cultural fabric. But when you got the MacArthur Grant, which comes with enough money to allow freedom, you started doing more research, you started traveling, you started interviewing, it enabled you to further explore your passion, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah.
Yeah. It allowed me to travel the country and reach people who are no longer here in time enough to interview them and get valuable information.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll bet that was an incredibly enriching experience. And now, it's not just me, but every time you're introduced somewhere, it's like, yes, MacArthur winning pianist. Nonsense. You're a grand talent on your own. But that's a cool thing to have gotten, a very cool thing.
Yes.
So we're talking about Bronzeville. We're talking about this event Saturday night at 7 o'clock at 27th and State Street, an evening at the Pekin Theater, which has had a huge influence on the life and music of Reginald Robinson and Tim Samuelson, the cultural historian of the city of Chicago, which I think is a great, great, great title and well-deserved, because he gets history in a way that makes it we're going to praise him. He gets history in a way that makes it come alive. Don't you think, Reginald?
I do. Yeah.
His passion for it is such that it becomes alive and it becomes real and it does not become academic and dusty. You know, and another thing about Bronzeville that was always stunning to me is that it was not until 1932 that Bronzeville or any African-American neighborhood had a library.
That's true.
That is shameful. I think it's shameful. It took Julius Rosenwald, one of the great philanthropists of our time, to build a library down there.
Yeah, that's there were some that were small ones in schools.
Oh, yeah.
But in terms of a major facility, no. And it was a great omission, and that it took that long. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for people like Vivian Harsh to...
The first black African-American librarian.
And pull together a library and also an archive of historical material relating to the neighborhood and really strengthen an identity that was a long time in coming.
Well, you think, you know, Reginald, you have been able to, given some resources, to explore and research, and that enriches your own music.
Yeah.
And you think to yourself, well, they had no library. That's the other sad thing now. There are a number of public schools in Chicago that have no libraries either, and that's another heartbreaking thing. And one thing that always has haunted me is that on Oakenwald, there's a park that was named for Vivian Harsh, and that is the park where Hydea Pendleton was shot. And that... in 2013. That is one of the haunting ironies of my life, frankly. So who's performing with you? No, let's wait. We got a minute before a break. What's Bronzeville like now, Tim Samuelson? I remember about 5 or 6 years ago, I knew these great two African-American guys who had opened a coffee shop down there and were hoping that the neighborhood would come back, and I think the whole housing nonsense thing has delayed that. Are you hopeful for Bronzeville? You know, it's right between the Loop and Hyde Park, man.
Well, I certainly am, and certainly the economic downturn of, you know, 2007, 2008 really disrupted a great momentum.
That's what I thought too, yeah.
There was considerable reconstruction of really, you know, good quality housing on the sites of what was torn down in urban renewal, and the establishment of really great independent businesses. And you don't see the construction quite the way it was, but there are a lot of great business enterprises which are really emerging and thriving in the area.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Which I feel very encouraged by. So,
if you feel it, then I feel it. Seriously.
But it is surprising how that economic downturn was devastating in general, but it really disrupted a really positive momentum.
Yeah, I felt the same thing. We have to take a short little break, and then Reginald Robinson is going to tell us who else he is performing with Saturday night, 7 o'clock, 27th and State Street. That's all you need to know. That's all you need to know. It doesn't cost anything. Tim Samuelson will be there with his lovely wife, Barb. I will be there, and I never go out, so it's a chance to see me and whatever. So it's going to be a concert setting, sort of?
Yeah. It's going to be right across from the site of the Pekin.
Oh, wow.
So you will be looking at the Pekin, and it will be like a concert, and it will be a capsulized version of what you'd see at the Pekin Theater years ago.
Sounds fantastic. Dude, it's hard to do a lot of research about the Pekin Theater. You're getting a lot of it here. You'll get a little more after a short commercial break, and you will hear Reginald Robinson play again. You hear singing. Someone sings with you. We'll be right back. Only a few more minutes with cultural historian and great friend of mine, Tim Samuelson, and one of the great musicians on the planet, Reginald Robinson. He will win a million awards in his life. They will both be, Tim, not doing any performing, just observing and partaking and enjoying an evening at the Pekin Theater, which features Reginald, is going to be, as Tim just told you, sort of trying to resurrect what it would have been like to go to the Pekin Theater, which was at 27th and State. Reginald, what is the performance going to be like?
Well, I can speak about the music.
Yeah.
We'll be playing, me and other musicians, luminary musicians in the city, we'll be playing pieces from the era of the Pekin Theater.
Oh,
and many pieces from the, you know, that were written for shows at the Pekin Theater. Yes.
What kind of shows? There was dramatic shows. They had operas there. They had basically everything there, right?
Yes. Yeah. They would perform, they would create and perform entire stage shows. Many of them were topical to what it was like living in Bronzeville at the time, which was accompanied by with music, dancing, comedians, the great Afro-British musician Samuel Coleridge Taylor actually performed at the Pekin at one time. Even as a community center, when there was the famous heavyweight championship in 1910 between Jim Jeffries and Jack Johnson, they actually had a telegraph hookup where the fight results were telegraphed to the Pekin Theater, where people could hear the progress of the fight. And they had Jack Johnson's mother there on stage.
Oh, my God.
And was there when the telegraph message came that Jack Johnson was the champion.
It's interesting, Tim and Reginald, that given that this place sort of vanished in 1911, there cannot be anybody at the event Saturday night who actually went to the Pekin Theater. But there have got to be perhaps some relatives of some of those people. Yes.
Why, as a matter of yes.
Yes.
And so relatives of the musical director, the great impresario, Joe Jordan, is going to be there,
yes.
Is coming to Chicago just for this performance.
Yes.
Reggie, does that put any pressure on you? Do you feel any pressure?
No.
Feel joy.
That's a great thing. That's an honor. And, it's, you know, I consider them family. They're like family to me.
And, Reginald is basically, if you're doing the historical counterpart, Reginald is Joe Jordan. He is the musical director, and he is in charge of the orchestra. And so he is the inheritor of Mr. Jordan, and a very worthy one at that.
Thank you.
That must make you proud.
Yeah, it's a good feeling. You know, I know it's a lot of responsibility, though.
How often do you play around these days? How often do you perform?
I would say occasionally.
Yeah.
Lately, dealing with this show, this is different. I've never done anything like this. So I've been pretty busy at home.
Yeah.
Working on music at home. But I play occasionally around the city and out of the city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You play internationally, of course.
Yeah. I should mention recently I did, I think one of the biggest things that's coming up this year is the first ever recording of my music in orchestra form. So that'll be coming out around, I'll say in August.
Where'd you record?
It was recorded in Michigan, but it was recorded with, you know, orchestra, recorded in 15 of my
All original tunes?
These are all of my original pieces, yeah. Wow. And some new pieces that were not, never been heard before. So,
how do you feel you've grown? The MacArthur thing, again, I'm talking about, not talking about the money part of it, but the freedom part of it. Do you feel a sense of growth as a performer and a composer?
I feel a sense of more respect. Huh. I get more respect now. You know? I think people realize that, you know, not just anybody just gets a MacArthur, you know, that's a rare and very distinguished award. So I get more respect for what I do.
Yeah. You know? Tim Samuelson, this is a very good kid, don't you think?
Why, I would say so. No, he's pretty amazing. Known him for a long time and never known
him. How did
you
two first meet?
How did we met, I think, through our mutual friend Chris Ware, who is also a great ragtime enthusiast.
Yes.
And so
And a pretty good artist.
Yeah. I think I may have known you maybe after, a little bit after. I don't know. I met you just after Chris.
Yeah, but you know, I would have to say the pool of ragtime aficionados is relatively small. So
It is.
Well, yeah, but Reginald's got to be growing it a bit, because when you hear him play and when you hear ragtime, which people I don't think hear enough, I think there's something about it that is, in the same way it grabbed you, you know, okay, oh, yeah, I heard the Sting. Yeah, I saw the Sting. Big deal.
Oh, well, forget
yeah,
about the Sting.
I know.
But it is interesting, too, is with Reginald, is that it not only has done great scholarship in ragtime music, but he is also carrying it forward in writing
exactly.
new compositions and taking it in new directions.
Yeah.
One of the things that always really impresses me as a story with Reginald is, for the people who have studied ragtime, and he has really expanded the audience for this, there was a photograph that was taken after Scott Joplin's death, the great ragtime composer, of his piano. And people saw this picture, and it was published for years. Everybody knew it. And it took Reginald to really look close and realize that on the piano was some handwritten manuscript.
Wow.
And he was able to take magnifying glass and microscopes and recreate this score that actually is this little – how long does it go? How many seconds?
31.
31 seconds of a lost Scott Joplin composition.
Oh, wow.
It took Reginald to look at this photograph that every music scholar interested in ragtime had looked at and come up with a 31-second of a lost Joplin piece.
You know what I realize is that historians had seen the photograph, but many of them had not thought about looking at that sheet music that was on the piano.
That's what makes you a Rick Cogan genius. Reginald Robinson and Tim Samuelson, Saturday night, 7 o'clock at 27th and State Street. That's all you need to know. Be there. You two guys, I admire you beyond words. We're going to end with, as you walk out the door, what is Sweetie Dear?
Sweetie Dear was a piece that Joe Jordan wrote probably around 1905.
And who's singing on this piece?
This recording was done with the great singer, one of the founding members of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, Rhiannon Giddens.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, good night, Tim. Good night, Reginald. Here you go.
Just glisten like pearls. Sweetie's dear smiles and winning wiles set my poor heart
What a show. I much enjoyed it. I hope you did too, listening. Aubrey Mumpower, thanks for your expertise engineering. Lise Graham, thanks for participating, bringing on a guest, doing 90% of the interviewing, and just running this show like a smooth operation. Come out next Saturday, 27th and State Street, 7 o'clock. I will see you there, or if you can't make it, I'll see you on the radio next Sunday. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.